The Guardian.
Welcome to Music Weekly. I'm Alexis Petridis. This week, DJ historian Bill Brewster comes into the studio for a special feature looking at the history of Trax Records. And in Singles Club, we cast an ear over tracks from REM, Wretch 32 and Cat's Eyes. This is Music Weekly from The Guardian. I'm joined today by the Richard Keys and Andy Gray of Music Criticism. It's Rosie Swash here as ever. Hello, Rosie.
Hello.
And Jude Rogers.
Do me
hello,
a favour,
Jude.
Love. Hello.
Hello, how you doing? You all
I'm
right?
All right, thank you.
Excellent, excellent. So, Rosie, Nicki Minaj, what happened there? I gave it a big build-up last week.
That's your bag, because you know what these hip-hop stars are like.
I know, but I thought she was very specifically coming to London to hang out with you.
Yeah, I know. I thought that too. I also got a bit excited because someone with the words Nicki Minaj in their Twitter name started following me, and I actually thought it was her, but it was just a fan club.
Oh, man.
It was one of those ones where there's like 900 different journalists trying to get 4.5 minutes with and da-da-da, and it just tumbled out of my reach, unfortunately.
I can't hide my disappointment at this.
Yeah, but you know what it would have been like. Like, the interview I would have loved her to have done, I don't think that would have happened. It will be this, you know, veneer.
I would have thought the interview you'd have loved her to have done would have been in her amazing British accent.
Yeah, I was going to ask her. I was going to ask her to do it in the Roman Zelensky voice.
Never mind, we don't need Nicki Minaj. We are going to start the programme today with an extended feature about the history of Trax Records. 2010 was the 25th anniversary of the legendary Chicago house label, probably the label that gave us house music, you could argue. And through his website and a few collaborations with Trax fans, the DJ historian Bill Brewster, probably best known as the author of co-author of Last Night a DJ Saved My Life, which is pretty much the definitive history of dance music. Bill's compiled a collection of re-edited Trax classics, all sorts of things on there, amazing stuff. Ralphie Rosario's Used to Hold Me, Baby Wants to Ride by Frankie Knuckles, Washing Machine by Mr. Fingers, all that good stuff. It's coming out very soon, and so earlier this week, Bill came in to talk us through some of the tunes that are on the record and the history of the label Trax. How did Trax start? Where did it come from as a record label?
Chicago. Mm-hmm. Larry Sherman was the owner of a pressing plant in Chicago, and people started to bring early house productions to him to get them pressed. And Sherman realised once a few of these people had come that there was a business opportunity. So essentially he could do everything. They would bring him the record, he would press it, he'd distribute it, and then he'd pay them or not pay them a royalty.
I mean, that's one of the famous things, isn't it? It's a degree of sharp business practice. Euphemistically,
yeah,
put.
Yeah, I mean, the whole of American music industry is based and built on those sharp practices. So it's almost unfair to single out Larry Sherman because he was just carrying on a noble tradition in the industry. There were labels like Gherkin that were kind of smaller and probably a bit more sophisticated, and because of that sold far fewer copies. But Trax and DJ International had cornered the market, really. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, once you've cornered the market, everyone wants to record for you because they know that if you get your record on Trax, you might get to DJ in London, you might get to DJ in Berlin, and so on. So it became a very attractive thing. So even though they knew that they were probably going to get ripped off, they were happily doing it. And a lot of them were like 18, 19, 20. They were young and, you know, the same as kids in an indie band now who are 18 and easily manipulated. But also, in a way, they kind of, I hate to say this, but some of the musicians did bring it on themselves. They kind of got ripped off once, knew they were going to get ripped off, and yet would turn up to Larry's office knowing that they would get an advance or a new car out of it and give him the money, probably knowing that he wouldn't account and they wouldn't get royalties. So it was a kind of a one of those mutually abusive relationships, really.
Why is Trax such an icon? I mean, there's two main house labels. There's Trax and DJ International are the two that seem to be putting most of the silly stuff out. Why is Trax the really iconic one?
I think it's because of the bad pressings, the really bad artwork. There's something kind of punk rock about Trax that wasn't there with DJ International. I think DJ International was a slightly more professional operation. But I think the iconography of it comes really from how crap it was in some ways. And also, you listen to some of the records now, and at the time I thought they sounded really bright and shiny and futuristic, but actually, they sound quite bad. I mean, they sound really punky and badly produced. To me, they only sounded the same as electro records that were coming out at the time. They sounded electronic and shiny to me. With hindsight, they don't sound electronic and shiny at all. They just sound electronic and a bit incompetent. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I really thought they sounded futuristic and all of those kind of things that dance music often conjures up.
That's not an opinion that was sort of widely shared when house music first came to Britain. It got a fairly rough ride off a lot of audiences, didn't it?
Well, not among black kids. It was really big in black clubs in the north, for example, in Sheffield and Nottingham, which is where I first heard it. I used to go to the Garage in Nottingham, where Graham Park was DJing, and there were a lot of black kids that listened to it. And obviously what helped it take off was adding ecstasy to the pot, basically. And that actually is what alienated a lot of black kids. Conversely, in London, a lot of the black kids were kind of very anti it. I remember Noel Watson telling me when he was DJing and playing early house, he used to get bottles thrown at him, and they had to build a cage around the DJ booth because all these black kids that had previously gone to listen to him playing hip-hop had violently reacted to him starting to play house records. So it was a different reaction in London.
Was that just a case of people being resistant to a new sound, or is there an element of homophobia about that? Because, I mean, it is, in America, it's utterly linked to a very specific gay scene.
It is, yeah. I think it was more to do with the sound, because the thing about house was a lot of the people that championed it, prior to them starting to play house, they play a couple of go-go records, a couple of hip-hop records, they play a classic old funk record, maybe a crazy rockabilly record, and then an electro record. And then all of the early house DJs, they suddenly just played only house. Mm-hmm. And it was quite confrontational. I remember seeing Mark Moore play at The Fridge in 1987, and it just felt like someone who was being deliberately confrontational rather than prior to that, where you just felt the DJ was sort of an entertainer. Mm-hmm. And I remember talking to him a few years later about it, and he just said, I was on a mission. I was on a mission to convert people to this because I just thought it was so great. But at the time, I thought, I hate it.
Because it sounded monotonal, because it was all the same beat, because it's all
all of those things. And then I got taken to a gay club by an ex-girlfriend and given them, you know, one of Mummy's little helpers. And then, you know, I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
It wasn't long before records like Pump Up London were coming out, being made in Chicago specifically because they knew there was a big market in the UK. So it didn't take long for export to start happening, and also for record labels in the UK to start showing an interest. I think the first tour over here was in 1987.
Pump it up, UK, London, pump it up, Manchester, pump it up, Liverpool, pump it up.
The other thing that's striking about Trax's output is how varied it is sonically, because you tend to assume that a music scene is going to follow, you know, particularly for coming from quite a small regional area, is all going to follow one sound. And while you've always got the kind of 808 kick drum and all that kind of thing going on, there is quite an immense sonic difference between a record like Washing Machine and a record like Your Love. There's things where you can really tie it in, house music, you can really tie it into sort of disco, you can see it as an offshoot of disco. And there's other things that just sound like, well, this came from Mars. I have no idea.
Well, I think you can tell the difference between the ones that were musicians and the ones that weren't. And the ones that sound very punk rock are obviously the ones that weren't musicians. And then people like Larry Heard obviously were musicians, and Jamie Principle obviously was a musician, and you can really hear that in their records. You listen to them now and there is a definite polish and quality to them that is probably not there in some of the others. Now, that doesn't necessarily make them better.
No.
But it does make them a little bit more shiny than some of the other Trax records. Waiting on my angel, looking towards the sky. My eyes are looking for passion. Will angel arrive? Dreaming of the moment when your lips touch mine. Making love in soft colored lights, way up in the sky. We should talk a little bit about Virgo. Weirdly, of all the Trax artists, they have perhaps the most mythic reputation. Why do you think there's this kind of weird, mythic, greatest house album of all time reputation around Virgo? Because they disappeared, I think. I tried to track them down a few years ago, and I found one of them was registered with an actor's agency, and I tried to sort of get in touch with them through then. But A, the quality of the music was very high, and B, the fact they disappeared. I mean, those two factors make for a perfect mythical album, really, don't they? You know, it's like Nick Drake's albums being ignored while he's alive, and then, you know, the myth growing after his death.
There's a real weird emotional pull, I think, to their music, above and beyond the kind of dance floor factor or anything like that, where, I keep mentioning this on the podcast, there was a melancholy undertow to a lot of dance. But the thing I love about the Virgo album is the melancholy seems to almost totally overwhelm everything else, you know?
Well, it's the story of dance music, really, that you're kind of celebrating, but celebrating with almost entirely minor key records. It's kind of... there's a lot of the best records are minor key, almost all of them minor
key. That's really interesting.
The only one that I can think of in a major key is Big Love by Pete Heller. That was in a major key, but a lot of them are minor keys.
How long did Trax last for?
The halcyon period was from about 85 to 90, although they did continue to release records, occasionally good records, well into the 90s. They didn't have the same kind of pull in terms of artists after that.
Was that because all these sort of big artists that we're talking about, Farley Jack, Master Funk, Frankie Knuckles, Mr. Fingers, could come to England and get sort of major label money? I mean, that's got to be a better pull.
Well, Frankie Knuckles began to be managed by Judy Weinstein, who still manages Frankie, and she would not put up with what Trax were doing, so he would definitely have been out of the picture. And also, he had a major label deal with Virgin by 1991 or something like that. A lot of them did get major label deals, so I guess the real talent pool had disappeared. Baby wants to ride, baby wants to ride. The reason why I don't think a lot of it works on major labels, apart from bands like Chemical Brothers and Underworld, which they effectively turned into rock bands,
yeah,
is because of the speed that it needs to move at. It can't be accommodated in a major label. And the other thing you have to remember about, like, Trax records and most really good dance music is it's really about functionality before anything else. So if you're in an indie band, you write a song and then you rehearse it, then you go and play it. But with with dance music, you'll make something in the studio, you'll go and play it, road test it. If it doesn't work, you'll go back and you'll shorten that bit, you'll lengthen that bit, you'll chop that bit out. Mm. And the fact that some of it happens to be great art is almost of a secondary point. You know, the first thing is, does it make a crowd move? Mm-hmm. Does it work on a dance floor?
If you had to pick one, what's your favourite record that Trax put out?
God, that's really hard. Well, I have to say the first record I ever bought on Trax, which I heard on John Peel, is probably my favourite just because it was the first one I bought, and that's Hey Rocky by Boris Badenoff.
That's not in a style that you would associate with Trax at all. I mean, that's more of a hip-hop kind of Steinsky isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of a house record, but it's also as much a Steinsky type record as well. I'd say Boris Badenoff.
The great Bill Brewster there, discussing the rise and fall and all the great music in between of Trax records. Ladies. I mean, this is an area of me. Ladies. Yeah. Listen to that. I'm infused with the spirit of Baby Wants to Ride by Jerry Principal. This is a kind of music that I really, really, really love. I really love early house music. There's a sense in which I tend to view it a bit like Motown, mid-60s Motown, and early kind of 1967-68 ska, in that I kind of think there's something totally undeniable about it, and if you don't like it, you probably don't like music very much.
Yeah.
Once again, I find myself playing on the subject of your youth, Rosie, but I mean, this is obviously something that happened way before your time. Does it sort of resonate for you as a younger listener, this stuff?
Well, it's one of those areas of music that I came to completely backwards, because by the time I was at a point where house music would have been on my radar, it had already evolved into really overcooked commercial stuff, the Ministry of Sound stuff. Mm. It had kind of seeped into that whole period of mid-90s trance records that were everywhere. And the UK garage had taken off by that point, which spoke to me much more.
Sure.
In fact, the first time I ever went to UK garage show, it was a stone's throw away from where we're sat now, Bagley's.
Was it Bagley's? Who did you see?
Who was on God, Bagley's? I can't remember. It was One Nation.
Right.
I was 14.
You're 14?
Yeah.
Wow.
Can't get in trouble with...
Oh, my God.
I don't even know. Anyway.
But you can't get... They have actually knocked back this down, so I don't think anything worse can happen to Bagley's than the fact that it's been raised to the ground. So.
Yeah. But, so there was a real feeling that I had of this just wasn't of interest to me. And now, even when I heard records like Your Love by Frankie Knuckles, which is just still so incredible.
What an amazing tune.
And the record that it lifted something... Carrots and Beets as well. And I'd, you know, I'd get these drips and feeds from it and I would never really investigate it. And then there was, a couple of years ago, the whole Italo Disco revival. Mm-hmm. And that's when I started to go back and kind of reevaluate it. And I think what I like about it, which is something that Bill kind of touched on, is the Roland technology was just coming to be.
Yeah.
And they're really excited by it, but it now sounds so old. Mm. And so you have this combination of something which sounds really retro and kind of restrained, or certainly has these boundaries, which we can hear from, you know, however many years later. But you still feel this total excitement in the tracks themselves.
I mean, Bill was saying, I don't know if there's a bit that was sort of edited out of that interview, that what they were effectively trying to do was sort of make Italo records. It's the kind of classic history of all rock music, I suppose, in a way, is people trying to copy things and getting it slightly wrong and making something different or better. Jude!
I liked your comparison, talking about, you know, in terms of your tastes with, you know, mid-60s Motown and kind of late-60s ska. I've always been really pulled in by there's a kind of innocence about it.
Yeah.
When I first kind of liked this kind of music, you know, I complete indie kid who came into dance music a lot later because I was scared of anybody who went to clubs and, you know, went to the big Escape in Swansea.
Right.
Everybody was terrifying who went there, and I went to the Zone where we listened to goth music.
Right.
But there's something very innocent about it and very joyful about it, as you say. The geek in me absolutely loves the fact that 303s have been around for a while, and then somebody, you know, started playing with different settings and overrides and all this kind of stuff, and then something weird happened. And I love when a sound can come to completely change music. You know, when it, even if it's like a, you know, a drum solo from the Leg Sticks, it just gets picked up as a, you know, something as a breakbeat and carries on. I just think it's, I really love anything about this. I have that geeky fascination by it. But I could listen to music like this all day because it has like a combination of innocence and, as you say, incredible melancholy.
Yeah. It's really interesting because there is a real innocence about it, and yet the circumstances it was designed for. If you read about places, clubs like the Music Box, this is the least innocent environment you can possibly imagine. It's loads and loads of gay guys totally having it on the most insane cocktails of drugs you can possibly imagine. And I find that really intriguing. I find the idea that it was music made for a very specific subculture, much more so than disco, I think, because disco is something that evolves, whereas house music is really aimed at effectively two gay clubs in Chicago at one point. And it goes on to swallow the world, you know. Then back to the point you made about the Roland 303. You know what the Roland 303 was built to do?
Initially?
Yeah.
Tell me.
Accompany buskers. The idea was that you would have a Roland 303. Which
just for the bass, wasn't it, initially?
And it would not give off sort of bass line, and you would sort of play the streets of London or equivalent over the top of it. And somebody realised that if you sort of tweaked it, you got that acid
squelch sound. I used to bass line, not for buskers. I used to busk.
Did you have a 303?
On the violin, you know, outside...
Wow, amazing.
It's, I would love to see footage of this.
I used to play Pachelbel's Canon, Ave Maria, and various Welsh hymns outside Llanelli Marks and Spencer's when I was about 16.
Wow, did you do well?
Was it and I was just like, you know, a Nirvana fan, basically, with lumberjack shirt and jeans. They just, you know, couldn't get a job, so I just busted.
Sure.
I can't believe you didn't take that outfit down to, what was it, Escape?
Should have took your violin.
As you could see, my club background is hard and fast.
We've got a message here. I must have mentioned this feature was on this show last week. James312 says, please talk about Marshall Jefferson. He doesn't get enough respect for being one third of Future, and those amazing Jungle Wands releases at True Genius. I would agree. Time Marches On by Jungle Wands. Yeah, Move Your Body by Marshall Jefferson. Amazing track. Time Marches On by Jungle Wands. One of these, like the Virgo album that we talked about on there, one of these unbelievably melancholy, just heartbreaking kind of deep house records. Just an amazing, amazing record. And obviously Future, acid tracks, you know, vitally, vitally important figure. The really interesting thing is these people, they're held up in Britain, you know, and particularly in the dance community in Britain, as the absolute pioneers, as the people that really started everything house-based. In America, no one knows who they are. It's absolutely remarkable. I mean, not no one knows who they are, but again, outside of a subculture that has largely remained gay, black, Puerto Rican, you know what I mean? Your average punter on the street doesn't know who Frankie Knuckles is, doesn't know who... I remember a friend of mine made a documentary about dance music for the BBC, and one of the things he did was he went with Frankie Knuckles to the site of The Warehouse, which is one of these clubs where house music, probably the club where house music started in Chicago, which is now an office block. And he took Frankie Knuckles into the office block and all these people working there, and he went, well, this is Frankie Knuckles, the godfather of house music, and this is where it all started. And it was clearly, you could just see the expressions on these people's faces. One, they had no idea who this big, fat, black, gay guy was that was quite flamboyant. But yeah, I just think there's something a bit kind of, there's something really sad about the story of tracks. Because they all got ripped off to a really alarming degree. And I know Bill said it's partly their own fault, but there's just something ghastly about you really started something. You started something that changed the face of music, certainly in this country, forever. And you never got anything back. There's something incredibly melancholy about the music. One day I will get to the root of why dance music is all in a minor key and why
that
it's all
really
sad.
Fascinating, isn't it?
I'd be really interested. Bill said Pete Heller's Big Love is the only dance record he can think of in a major key. Any musically minded dance fans out there listening to this podcast can suggest some others. I'd be really intrigued to know. I don't know why the melancholy comes into dance music, but there's something that I really, really love about it. The album that Bill helped compile, Tracks Reedited, is out on February the 7th. Bill's site is at djhistory.com. There are other compilations. If this has piqued your interest and you don't know the original releases on Tracks, there are other compilations around. If you want a really good taste of early house music, if you can dig it out, I'm sure you can get it on eBay and secondhand because it's been deleted. Mastercut's Classic House Volume 1. I would say possibly the greatest compilation album in any genre of all time. Wow. I'm really passionate about this stuff, man. I get really choked up when I talk about it because there's something just... There is something really moving about the whole story and the notion that... Anyway, we're getting completely off the point. But yeah, I do get
pass him some tissues.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to start filling up. Before I start crying, singles club time now. Three tracks, one from each of us, and we're going to start with Jude's pick. That was Oberlin by R.E.M.
Yeah.
Oberlin,
I believe.
Jude's choice. Jude, tell us about why you brought this in.
Well, I brought this in. Firstly, R.E.M. have a new album out next month. Mm-hmm. They've been dripping tracks onto the internet. Rather unpleasant. Yeah, they've on their
oozing
YouTube site and through the Huffington Post and various mm-hmm. places.
Okay.
There's like four or five tracks online now from the album, which is interesting. Because, you know, you're thinking R.E.M. are one of these bands who are, you know, a bit of a warhorse. They've been around forever. Obviously, you know, they were massively successful commercially for a long time, not as much anymore. Mm. And I thought that was quite interesting in terms of, you know, how a big band, maybe slightly down their uppers, but well-known, are trying to promote themselves. Mm. I also brought it in because I wanted to talk to you about bands like that and how they work today. Now, R.E.M. were the band that were my big epiphany band as a young teenager.
Okay.
I wrote a 14-page fan letter to Michael Stipe on both sides of paper and sent it to him, and he never replied.
Some people. You'd think you'd think he'd have nothing better to do.
No, exactly.
At the peak of his career.
Exactly. Now, I've been an R.E.M. apologist for years and years and years. You know, I've found something in most of their records and always get excited when a new R.E.M. record comes out. Everything I've heard of this album just makes my heart completely cave in a bit.
And what, in a bad way or
In a bad way. That song, you know within about 2 seconds that it's R.E.M. Mm. All the features of R.E.M. are there. There's the Peter Buck's guitar intervals. There's kind of little details. Like at the beginning of that song, it starts, "Hey, now," and it's exactly like, if anybody remembers Drive off Automatic for the People, it kind of almost follows exactly that pattern. It's a bit R.E.M. by numbers, and a lot of the other songs are a bit R.E.M. by numbers, and I get the sense now that they might be just going for, let's go for the anthems that can be played on Grey's Anatomy, which does make me a bit sad, because the last album, Accelerate, wasn't the greatest album in the world, but it had this kind of fiery spirit about it, and this kind of renewed sense of vigour about it, which I thought was quite impressive in men in their late 40s or early 50s. And also, live, last time I saw them live, last couple of times I've seen them live, best they've ever been. They've really gone back to their early material, which remains the greatest stuff that they've done. And little elements are filtered through here, but it just feels like they're trying to write something off, say, one of their mid-80s albums, and but also trying to gloss it out in a way.
I feel a bit sorry for R.E.M. because I think they're sort of trapped to a degree in a sort of cycle. I mean, there's two different cycles they're trapped in. One is they put a new album out and everyone goes, the startling return to form of R.E.M. And it never really is quite a startling return to form as it's claimed and da-da-da. And there's that sort of expectation and then, you know,
why do you think they get that and say you too don't get it? Because there's still that warmth towards them? Or because they were quite weird, you know, in terms of a...
But they weren't quite. They weren't that weird, R.E.M.
Their music wasn't that weird, but
the stuff around them
was weird.
Yeah. I think that there's a degree of warmth towards them. I think people want R.E.M. to be really good.
Yeah.
I also think that they're trapped in a sense of... about people... They're sort of trapped by people's expectations in that when they've made albums that try to sort of deviate from the sort of, you know, you say the R.E.M. by numbers thing. People have not really, you know, Monster, New Adventures in Hi-Fi, people didn't really go for those kind of things. You know, people, I think R.E.M. fans want a very specific thing from R.E.M.
Well, my favourite R.E.M. album is probably Up, which is the album that came out just after Bill Berry had left in 1998, which is very electronic. It was...
I meant Up when I said Monster, actually.
Yeah,
sorry.
I thought Up was absolutely wonderful. And I know a lot of fellow R.E.M. nerds that really like it as well, not just
maybe
to be kind of obscure.
Maybe you should write another 14-page double-sided letter to Michael.
Dear Michael.
You might be a little less busy this time,
right? Because you're not as popular.
I still love you,
But, you know, he's cool-looking. He's got a great voice.
Rosie, are you an R.E.M. fan?
No, and I've always hated them.
Moving swiftly, what is it that you hate about?
Obviously, we all know about my UKG history. There was the band who awakened me to moving out of the UKG territory was Pulp. I mean, I still... there's I, adore them. Yeah. I didn't understand it. You know what I mean? It was just like His and Hers was that kind of album where you just, what is happening? Who is this person? And I get the feeling that that is the sentiment that people who came to REM at a very important point in their formative years had when they discovered Michael Stipe and they discovered REM. And I just never got it. I did think that this was losing my religion. And because in the video, it goes along the Berlin subway. Is that what it does? So I thought, have they done like a rework of Losing My Religion for the Berlin subway, which would be kind of cool. Might actually make me want to. So I think it sounds like REM by numbers, but to me, REM has always sounded a little bit by numbers. I find him so uncompelling and really irritating. I'm sorry. It's horrible when people like...
It's all right, you know. I've got more of a chance now. Yeah. Apparently, though, on this record, they do something with peaches.
Okay.
And that does intrigue me. You know, kind of like, as peaches hasn't a great deal recently. And
she's just done a duet with Amanda Palmer, which is all about bikini lines.
Oh, amazing. She's like a kind of like nutso Lady Gaga before Lady Gaga. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with, you know, extra...
Okay. Let's move on. Move on to my selection. That's Cat's Eyes and Not a Friend, which is a free download available from Cat's Eyes website. If you don't know, Cat's Eyes is the new sort of side project of Faris Badwan from The Horrors. And I like this for a number of reasons. I mean, partly I'm fascinated by the fact that I now sort of think, wow, the side project from the guy, this is going to be good. It's the guy, The Horrors. Whereas when The Horrors first came out, I can't think of a band that have gone from this sort of joke, almost like laughing stock that they were perceived as, obviously very incorrectly, to being taken as seriously as they are now. And I think that's because there was a false impression of what they were like when they started. And I've met them and interviewed them a couple of times, and they really know their music in an unbelievably nerdy record collector way. I think Spider Webb very proudly told me that he was the youngest person ever to have his record collection featured in Record Collector magazine. But, I mean, that in itself, having lots of records doesn't make you a good band. What does make you a good band is a sort of understanding of the music that you're trying to make. And I think he has a really good understanding of the sort of girl group genre that he's playing with here. I also think another reason I probably like it is it reminds me a little bit of Broadcast. And one of the interesting things that happened after Trish Keenan's death was there was a sort of, you would never say there's a massive outpouring of public grief, but there was a massive outpouring of music journalist grief.
Yeah.
And this, I think, in my head sort of recalled something that's swathed in reverb.
I think you were in the same gig with me, Broadcast played in the vaults.
That's right.
Under London Bridge. Was that the night when you told her that you
that
loved
was
her?
When I, yeah, I thought drunkenly was. Told her that I loved her, and she just looked at me like I was totally mad. But I'm really glad I did that now.
Yeah.
You know?
It's funny, that's one of the first things I thought of was Broadcast. Not that it's not that they're trying to be Broadcast at all,
really.
But I think just because they're a band in my mind, it brings up a lot of those atmospheres of mid-80s kind of 4AD sort of stuff as well. You know, it's like a Cocteau Twins going girl group a little bit. It reminds me a bit of you know, the Concretes, the Swedish band.
Yep.
Their first record had a lot of stuff that was a little bit like this, but not as successful. Mm-hmm. But it's really, really beautiful.
Rosie.
I'm a real sucker for this kind of thing. I agree with everything that you were saying about, I think
good.
Particularly, yeah, end up.
For once.
I think what Jude was saying about the 4AD stuff, it's just got something instantly evocative about it.
Yeah.
But what I like about it is, I think Faris has said in past interviews that he's always wanted to do something like this, the girl group thing, and I've always been excited by that prospect because of his voice, which is very deep and sort of stern, and it makes me think of what you can get in the Lee Hazelwood, Nancy Sinatra vein when it just works.
Yeah.
And I think he has enough of an understanding of what a subtle touch, where that subtle touch is needed. She's an opera singer.
Yeah, because the girl from Ipso Facto used to sing with Faris. Mm. And I don't know if this was the same project or a different project. Yeah, because she doesn't really sound like an opera singer, this girl.
No,
maybe that's why the voice is so nice,
because she's reining it in so much.
Because when I initially saw the description of what it was, I thought it was going to be some sort of preposterous goth kind of grand guignol kind of singing, you know, and was really surprised and really taken aback when it was sort of, you know, quite, so you say, quite reined in. So there you go, Cat's Eyes and Not a Friend. Go to their website and you can download that track and see this video of them playing or not playing in the Vatican. Finally, we have Rosie's Choice. My life's all terribly wild, but you never catch me on the Jeremy Kyle show. Explosive, terrorist style. Don't think I'm a blow, I get to therapy now. Oh, I miss school and I haven't got a job yet. My couch is my daughter's on the way. I went clubbing till my world was revolving. Pretty women and alcohol. I ride small fucking beat like a tractor. I ride small fucking beat like a tree. Rosie, that is Tractor by Wretch32, a very hotly tipped rapper. Tell us a little bit about him and tell us a bit why you like this track.
Well, I heard it several times on Sunday. First of all, in being driven around in a car and listening to One Extra, which is actually very fun to do on a Sunday.
Cool.
CJ Beats. And I was like, instantly just thought, it's a new pass out. Of, you know,
interesting. Yeah.
It's not that it sounds so much like it, but it's true to something totally English, and it's true to its roots, as well as having instant, like, you just know it's going to have crossover appeal. And just like in Pass Out, these things, talking about his aunt's house, and he's like, taking piss out of the hills, and just being quite self-effacing, which is always so appealing because rappers and hip hop is, by and large, not a self-effacing genre.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when you get someone being very English and quite and having a bit of wit about it, I'm always, you know, really seduced by that. He also has that kind of voice where you just almost the delivery is a little bit painful for him or something like that, or it's just a bit weird. Do you remember Magoo, who used to rap with Timbaland, and he was on a couple of Missy's album?
Yes.
It's such a weird voice.
Yeah, him on an album with Timbaland, who can't
he's
rap.
A weird guy.
Well, he can't rap. And you'd get the two of them on together and there'd be some amazing kind of Timbaland production with this total, you know, appalling rapping.
I
want to
do an impression of Magoo's voice, but I'm too embarrassed. But it was kind of like...
Was it really amazing?
Was it really...
Well, he sounded like Mr. Bean.
Exactly. It was like really nasally and weird. And it's not like Wretch. I think it's Wretch 3-2. I'm not sure who got it.
Sorry,
I got that wrong.
It feels a bit kind of dub reggae, which some of Tiny Tempest stuff does, but it doesn't sound anything like Tiny.
Yeah.
I love Tiny Tempest so much. I was watching a video on the BBC BBC Radio 1 website of kind of Reggie Yates speaking to him, because I think he's in the top five now or something like that.
Is he?
Yeah.
So what happens when you listen to commercial radio on
what is going on? No, because I'll tell you what, I had Radio 1 on in the car on my way to Waitrose 2 Sundays ago. I'll tell you what's a good record. Whip My Hair. That's that was on. I really like that. And I just hadn't heard it. And I thought, well, I'm not going to... Because I'd heard about it. I thought, it's a record by a 10-year-old. And then there was another one on, like a...
Virgin by Madonna?
Yeah. You know what? That woman's going to be big. You mark my words. It's a bit controversial, the subject matter.
But
Far East movement, like a G6.
Did that just come to you? Or did that come via the producer?
It's a good record. I think that's been like number one for about 6 weeks. Yeah. I didn't know about it. But anyway, Carol, sorry
to you. It seems like it might get to the point and becomes a bit of a cliche to drop in these kind of, you know, very English references.
Yeah.
Because obviously Dizzy's been doing it for quite a while and Tiny Tempest record's full of it and here's another one. But I think because the sound of this record is so, it's like in little different sections. You've got this bit that sounds like dumb and, you know, he's kind of, his background is like a grime MC up in Tottenham or something like that, which I, you know, never heard him before now. So I don't know if his sound has changed completely, but it's got quite, it's not a very commercial sound in some respect.
I really like that aspect of it. I think it's good that things seem to be developing with those kind of, you know, crossover British rappers.
Yeah.
Away from making more straightforward pop music.
Mm. And it's the sound of it, which is interesting.
And it's like the thing that everyone's been waiting for, and it was what we talked about last week when we were talking about, not on the show, in the first album award judging panel, we were talking about the Tiny Temper album and why you just feel like people, rappers are still having to compromise. Mm. And this track doesn't feel like a compromise.
That's very true.
It doesn't, no, that's very true.
What a nice way to end Singles Club. A quick look through the podcast blog, or your comments on the podcast blog. We start with James312. I believe, wasn't he the guy that was on about Marshall Jefferson? Yes, he was. He liked the interview with Andy Butler from Hercules and Love Affair. He'd seen them recently and thought they were amazing. And he added, Daniel Wang was a huge influence on the NYC scene and should get a mention for releasing Disco 12 Inches on his label Ballyhoo Recordings since 1994. Well done. Yes, he should. Yeah, absolutely. That's a good... good call, I think. Hercules and Love Affair came into The Guardian and they performed a track for us, which there is a video of them doing, at guardian.co.uk/music. Go and check it out. Back to blog comments, and Tortuga Dorado in Madrid posted, I can't say I agree with a couple of derisive comments about Echo and the Bunnymen. I don't think, in fairness, we're making derisive comments about Echo and the Bunnymen. I think we're making derisive comments about bands sounding like Echo and the Bunnymen in this day and age. But anyway, they're much better than the current disciples. We are in agreement, Tortuga. E.g. White Lies, who despite their latest bland offering, fancy being as big as Kings of Leon, according to NME. I tell you what I found out this week. Did you know that Kings of Leon have their own clothing line?
What?
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's rock
like
and roll.
It's like
kind couture. Of clothes I wore when I was 16 busking outside Clacky Marks and Spencer.
There's a trilby, a Kings of Leon trilby. Yeah. 176 quid.
Oh my god.
176
quid to look like the biggest twat in the world.
That's the advertising slogan. It's amazing that you preempted that. You should go and work for Search and Search, isn't it? Pine O'Clean liked the interview with Beth Ditto and said, my opinion of Beth Ditto and her music has gone up after that interview. Hmm. I'm pleased to hear it. That's good.
Her solo... Sorry to interrupt. The solo stuff she's put out, that's pretty Chicago house.
It has got a hint of that kind of thing about it. I bet she likes that kind of
music. Yeah. It's a good move for her.
What, making a dance thing? Of course you weren't here last week. I was going to say, why are you talking about it? We talked about this last week. But of course you weren't here.
No.
So it's all right. No, we'll just go off and talk about something from last week, please. Yeah. No, I think it is better than... it's better than Last Gossip album. Zucotron posted, was neither a fan of Gossip or of Simian Mobile Disco before, but Open Heart Surgery is unexpectedly great. The rest of the EP all sounded a bit samey to me, just weaker variations on the same song. The combination of a voice and the music works well, they just need better tunes. Somebody give Vince Clark a ring. I'll be on the phone straight after that to my close personal friend Vince Clark. Okay, thank you very much, everybody. You can leave your Singles Club reviews and comments on anything else in this week's programme at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. And that is it. That's all for this week. Something of a house music special. Thanks again to Rosie and Jude for coming in. Thank you, ladies. Ladies, I'm doing it again.
No.
Pat, the culture of sexism that exists.
Terrible. We'll give you a slap later.
And violence. We'll be back again next Friday. I'm Alexis Petridis. The programme was produced by Scott Cawley. Thank you very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.